We want to welcome everybody here, everybody who is watching online, everybody who will watch later on the computer. And today, particularly if you're a visitor, you're very, very welcome. The first thing we do is we light a chalice to remind ourselves of the wider Unitarian community in Ireland and around the world, to indicate our appreciation for being able to gather in peace, and to remind us that in many countries, freedom of worship is discouraged, if not forbidden. We also take this opportunity to demonstrate our gratitude to Bridget, our minister, who, supported by Paul, has been serving us well, unstintingly, and with great humour over the years. And we do this especially as today is Bridget's birthday. We come to this sacred place to reflect, to meditate and to pray in our individual ways for peace in our troubled world, for the well-being of our families and friends, and most important, for anyone in this congregation who is ill or who, for whatever reason, is burdened and under pressure. We come in gratitude for the community we share with each other, and the support, peace, and comradeship of these Sunday mornings and the Wednesday afternoon reflections. Our first hymn, Morning Has Broken, number 38. Our first reading is by Andrew.
Morning, everybody. I got a great kick out of Gavin sharing with us last week that Bridget hasn't been a saint since 1969. And I had great glee going around telling everybody at work that she's not a saint, a bit like our own Bridget, not a saint, maybe a god, maybe a goddess. It's interesting, sometimes isn't it interesting how reading then just sort of suddenly appears and sort of ties in with something you've been thinking about. So I came across this reading this week, and it's by Mayor Angelou. And just forgive me, I'm reading this as a man, so if it's not my words, it's Mayor's. In my young years, I took pride in the fact that luck was called a lady. In fact, there were so few public acknowledgements of the female presence that I felt personally honored whenever nature and large ships were referred to as feminine. But as I matured, I began to resent being considered a sister to a changeling as fickle as luck, as aloof as an ocean, and as frivolous as nature. The phrase, a woman always has the right to change her mind, played so aptly into the negative image of the female that I made myself a victim to that unwavering decision. Even if I had made an inane and stupid choice, I stuck by it rather than be like a woman who changes her mind. Being a woman is hard work, not without joy and even ecstasy, but still relentless, unending work. Becoming an old female may require only being born with certain genitalia, inheriting long living genes and the fortune not to be run over by an out of control truck. But to become and remain a woman, command the existence and employment of genius. The woman who survives intact and happy must be at once tender and tough. She must have convinced herself or be in the unending process of convincing herself that she, her values, and her choices are important. In a time and a world where males hold sway and control, the pressure upon women to yield their women to wield their rights of way is tremendous. And it is under those very circumstances that a woman's toughness must be in evidence. She must resist considering herself a lesser version of her male counterpart. She is not a sculptress, a poetess, a poet, an authoress, a Jewess, a negress, or even now, which is rare, in university, a rectoress. If she is the thing, then for her own sense of self and for the education of the ill-informed, she must insist with rectitude of being the thing and being called the thing. A rose by any other name may smell as sweet, but a woman called by a devaluing name will only be weakened by the misnomer. She will need to prize her tenderness and be able to display it at appropriate times in order to prevent toughness from gaining total authority and to avoid becoming a mirror image of those men who value power above life and control over love. It is imperative that a woman keep her sense of humor intact and at the ready. She must see, even if only in secret, that she is the funniest and looniest woman in the world, which she should also see as being the most absurd world at all times. It has been said that laughter is therapeutic and amiability lengthens the lifespan. Women should be tough, tender, laugh as much as possible, and live long lives. The struggle for equality continues unabated, and the woman warrior who is armed with wit and courage will be among the first to celebrate victory.
Thank you, Andrew. Our second hymn, which is difficult, but we know the words, and Josh is going to play it through, and it's number 274, Dear Father, Dear Mother, Father of Mankind. Well, the story I'm going to tell you, and I know there are millions of children out there who may know about this story. It was told to me by my mother, and it's all about the snoodle bugs. And I don't know if you know about the snoodle bugs, but they came from Brexit. And the thing about the snoodle bugs was that nobody knows their sort of ethnic origin. And it was believed that perhaps they may have some distant relation to the Wombles. There was some sort of facial thing. And also they thought that maybe they came from, they were descended from the tribe of Farage. Now, the Sunday World, I think, investigated this, and they found that it was a malicious rumor, and that wasn't so. Anyway, like a lot of Brexit people, the snoodlebugs were having great difficulties getting enough to eat and to feed their children. And Ireland, which Brexiters had often rudely called the island of the shaggy dog, and the reason was because, as you know, if you turn a map of Ireland upside down, sideways and on its feet, it looks like a Scots terrier. And Ireland was very popular for Brexiters to go. And the reason was, of course, because the kings and the queens kept telling them to go there. And unfortunately, when they arrived in Ulster and in the Midlands and in Munster, many of the Brexiteers behaved very badly. They kicked people out of their houses and lands and forced them to go to Connacht. And Connacht wasn't a very nice place to go at the time because the farming land was, as you know, is not very good. But the snoodlebugs were not like that. And this goes to show that just because you're a particular background or live in a particular country or are part of a particular group, it doesn't mean that you have to follow the practices of the people in that group. So the snoodlebugs too were very concerned because they wanted to give a good example to their children. And they had two children, they had Hyacinth and Fortescue. Now, they arrived anyway by sailing boat to Dunleary, and they had to sell their castle, of course, in Brexit, because loads of people were selling theirs and they got very little money for their castle. And when they arrived in Dunleary, they had a number of problems. One of the big problems was the fact that a lot of dogs and a lot of poo on the streets, which really bothered them. And also, there was nowhere to park your cart or your carriage. But Mr. Snoodlebug, being the man he was, got involved in fishing and building houses. And then the problem became, of course, what they were going to do about schooling for Fortescue and Hyacinth. And they thought, and they looked around, and they asked people, and they told them that, well, the hairy child in Killiney was probably a very good one. And then the other one was Columbo's up in Rathfarnham. And they thought that these are good schools and we'll send our children there. So they were put into those schools. And of course, the problem was that Mr. Snoodlebug and his wife, they were running out of money and they had to sell a lot in order to pay the fees in these schools. But anyway, they had to go down to the south of Ireland and try and make some money. And they built up a whole herd of cattle. They had about 100 cattle. And if they sold one cow, they bought two others. And anyway, they were very kind and they were decent people. And they started to talk to the people who had been living in Ireland for many years. And they set up a donkey haven for abandoned donkeys. And later, during the Great Famine, they would look after people who were walking towards the workhouse. And they settled disputes. They would have been called mediators today. And they gave money to fix the roof of the local Catholic church. So these were good people. So they began to see themselves and to be seen by others as Irish. And as the decade went on, Hyacinth and Fortescue married. And Fortescue married a woman called Bridget. And before long, a number of the Snoodlebugs put an O in front of their name. And apparently, this is probably not true, it's hurtful, but they did it in order to get a job in the civil service. But if your parents ask you for the moral in this story, they can be slow sometimes, so maybe you'd explain it to them. But if there is a moral, just because people in your group misbehave, it doesn't mean that you have to. Even if people don't like you at first, even if they hate you, you can become friends if you're cooperative and friendly. And if you're a stranger in another country, work hard, be kind, and soon you will be accepted and prosper. So if you go home and explain that to your parents. The second reading is from a book by Christina Feldman, The Buddhist Path to Simplicity. The Buddha said so simply and clearly that the source of happiness and unhappiness lies nowhere else but in our minds and hearts. We can make endless journeys to find happiness and engage in countless strategies to rid ourselves of unhappiness. But the key traveler on all journeys and the central player in all the strategies in ourselves is ourselves, and it is to ourselves we always return. There is a wonderful Zen saying, "The only truth you find on top of a mountain is the truth you brought with you." We discover happiness through making peace with ourselves and the circumstances of our lives, not fantasies about the future. Our lives will continue to present us with unexpected challenges and opportunities. Our bodies will age and become fragile. Our teenagers will rebel. Our colleagues may frustrate us. Financial demands will continue to appear. We will meet with allies and adversaries. We will be asked to find room in our hearts for the needs of others, to embrace our own demons, and to respond to the changing circumstances of each moment. We make peace with our lives through learning to connect with the simple truths of each moment. As the graffiti on the bridge tells us, we are not in a traffic jam. We are the traffic jam. And that's from Christina Feldman, The Buddha's Path to Simplicity. Second reflection. Let us think today of all those people who are unhappy and who carry heavy burdens. Help us to understand and be supportive of them, and to realize that all people, regardless of age, gender, nationality, social class, or sexual preference, have their moments of sadness, times when they need our backing, patience, and gentle company. Now, Doreen will play for us Little Shepherd, and Josh will accompany her. It's a piece by Debussy. The address today is about happiness, and it comes with no particular conclusions, but it's a stab at dealing with something that we all have had to deal with at some stages in our lives. My mother, if she saw ostentatious wealth, say a sumptuous wedding couple, would often say, "But are they happy?" She knew, as many people do, that money doesn't bring happiness. And if it does, it's for a very short time. Once any deprivation has been eliminated, the research shows that for a limited trajectory, the sudden wealth brings a happy buzz, which then plateaus before the wealthy recipients return to their previous happiness level. The same phenomenon apparently occurs in the development of countries. And surprisingly, some influential thinkers believe that happiness is not possible for anyone. Even others, such as Sophocles, Euripides, and Byron, thought it would be better if we weren't born at all. For Ovid, the only time man is happy is at his death. Arthur Schopenhauer, perhaps one of the bleakest philosophers in the Western world, according to Stuart Wilson, says that we are inextricably enmeshed in a tangle of misery and pain, as if we had signed a bad contract without looking at the small print. A uniform grey, Walton says, he wrote a book called Emotional History, says that we are inextricably, says that there's a uniform grey in our lives. It's our natural colour, susceptible at best to being changed temporarily with entertainments, intoxication, or the rivalries of hard work and sexuality, but always seeping back to define us again. For Schopenhauer, our pleasures are illusory because there is no sensible intimation of them as pleasures compared with the gnawing authenticity of pain and disappointment. If life is a gift, he says, it's a piece of largesse one might have politely declined. And David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, believed that humankind was dismayingly good at contributing to its own unhappiness. The world God has designed, he said, is supremely efficient at denying us any happiness that we scarcely need to bother to make it worse. He believed there were a number of different causes for human misery. Among them, that there is no robustness in the human spirit to withstand the rigors of existence. There was, too, an immoderate tendency, he said, to ruinous extremes at work in nature to which man could only offer minimal resistance. In the same depressing vein, he added that we needed to look no further for proof of life's anxiety and tedium than the fact that we incessantly anticipate a life beyond life provided by religious belief. Saint Augustine also cast a cold eye on the possibility of happiness. The background, of course, is the Christian belief in original sin. He insisted that happiness only lay in the mind and memory. It was not a commodity that could be apprehended by the physical senses. In a world where all is ephemeral, only that which is immutable and true can be a source of genuine happiness. Rejoicing in God's existence renders the need for any sort of joy superfluous. As Augustine put it, "You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our heart is restless until it rests in thee." In the Jewish Christian tradition, suffering is the price paid by humanity for displeasing God. Forced out of Eden into a cold, comfortless world from which we must permanently seek shelter precisely because we now lack the direct protection of the Creator. And unhappiness, too, has been seen by others as resulting from a lack or a loss. Freud located all unhappiness, melancholia, in a sense of lack, but not so much as something missing, but as a loss, a sense that arises in early infancy as we are gradually separated from the maternal bond. Darren McMahon, in his book, The Pursuit of Happiness, writes, there is no greater modern assumption than that it lies within our power to achieve happiness. He tells us that the history of happiness began with the development of tragedy on the classical stage and in history itself. The tragic hero was the one who carried on beyond the merely human despite everything. This led, hundreds of years later, of course, to the Enlightenment, when man was introduced to the idea that everyone could and should be happy. Such happiness was not a gift from God or a trick of fate, but a natural human endowment obtainable in theory, which leads us into current ideas of happiness and its lack, and of course some ideas on what leading thinkers have written. There is a view, of course, held mainly by citizens of imperial countries, that in their colonial ventures, they brought happiness to the countries they overran. Alan de Botton, in his book Status Anxiety, describes a 16th century report on American Indians who led materially simple but psychologically rewarding lives. Their community was small, close-knit, egalitarian, religious, playful, and martial. They lived on fruits and wild animals and had few possessions. Even a chief might have no more than a spear and a few pots. They also, according to the report, had an impressive level of contentment. That is, until the Europeans arrived. Within a few decades, the status symbol system of Indian society was revolutionized through contact with technology and luxury. And what mattered became was no longer one's wisdom or understanding of the ways of nature, but one's ownership of weapons, jewelry, and alcohol. As de Botton says, they succumbed to the easy lures of the trinkets of modern civilization. The context is different, of course, but a similar bent towards material things emerges in a study in which people in North America were asked to declare items as necessities. In 1970, 20% said a second car was a necessity. In 2000, that figure was 59%. The corresponding percentages for a second TV were 3% and 45%. More than one telephone was 2% in 1970, and in 2000, it was 78%. And then the same applies to car air conditioning, home air conditioning, and a dishwasher. In 1970, only 88% of North Americans thought a dishwasher was a necessity. Now it's 44%. As de Botton points out, advertisements will fail to mention our tendency to cease appreciating anything after owning it for a short time. We are tempted to believe, he said, that certain achievements and possessions will guarantee us enduring satisfaction. We are led to imagine ourselves scaling the steep sides of the cliff face of happiness to reach a wide, high plateau on which to continue our lives. We are not reminded that soon after reaching the summit, we will be called down again into the fresh lowlands of anxiety and desire. So far, we've veered towards the depressing side of the argument on happiness. on those who believe that happiness is impossible or is rare. We've had a brief look at the dangers of materialism, and we'll now concentrate on what thinkers have said on the happy life and how we might achieve it. But first, for some light relief, let's look at the first president of Sinn Féin. He died in 1923. His name was Edward Joseph Martin. And we do this, if for no other reason than to see the preposterousness of many ideas for those seeking utopia. A word which literally means no place, but came to mean an ideal happy society. Martin was the son of wealthy landlords. He was sent to an English public school and, disliking the curriculum, decided to blow it up. He was only nearly expelled. At Oxford, he was a devotee of the aesthetic movement. He was then a unionist, reinforced by his lifelong contempt for the common people and his hatred of democracy. Martin was also a scrupulously devout Catholic and a misogynist. The result, it is said, of his mother's overbearing ways and his sexual orientation. He may have been attracted to nationalism by a semi-mystical delight in the Galway countryside and a growing dislike of England, which he associated with modern democratic materialism. He wanted to rid Ireland of all traces of the unclean world by restoring the Irish language and Celtic art. The Agatha Polis, our good state, would have no women and also no vice. The religion would be Catholic and the government a benevolent despotism, infinitely superior to democracy, which is the rule of the ignorant and the blind, he said. The language spoken would be Greek, and the arts would flourish, especially sculpture, because the sculptors would gain inspiration by watching boys as they exercised. Dramatic arts would benefit too, by the absence of female actors, and photography was regarded as a brutal barbarism. The Faber Book of Utopias has many such esoteric ideas on possible ideal and happy societies, and not all of them are as daft as Martin's, but they indicate that there were strenuous efforts to search the key to happiness. Although the Taoist Chuang Tzu tells us that happiness lies in not striving for happiness. Let's examine the culture of the emoji, of the smiley face, and the excruciating for some people saying, "Have a nice day." The smiley has been described as a symbol of cultural aspiration, capturing perfectly the will to good feeling that has continued to propel us forward. Michael Foley, in his book, The Age of Absurdity, writes that in the 1970s, two Americans copyrighted the symbol whose worldwide popularity, he said, rivaled that of the cross. Sadly, the man who created the symbol got only $45. And when asked, was he upset at all the income he had missed, said, "Hey, I can only have one steak at a time." A truly happy man, perhaps. Foley says there's been a shift in values in modern society. Changes being favored over stability, potential over achievement, anticipation over appreciation, collaboration over individuality, opportunism over loyalty, entitlement over obligation, and cheerfulness over concern. It is, too, an age of delusion. Apparently, everywhere and in all social classes, people report their happiness level at over 5 in a scale of 1 to 10, and are certain of even greater happiness in the future. An American psychologist, Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, says that most Americans and Europeans see themselves as above average on a wide range of talents, including virtuousness, intelligence, and of course, sexual performance. 94% of college professors think they do above average work, and similar percentages apply in the case of students and teachers. However, this desiderata delusion is weaker in East Asian countries, and according to Haidt, is probably non-existent in Japan. The question we have to ask is whether this is evidence of the beneficial influence of Buddhist culture, which attempts to dispel illusion and reduce attachment to the self. It seeks to find balance, the middle way, and this can involve ceaseless effort. The key Stoic virtue is detachment, with the view that if it is not possible to change the world, it is at least possible to moderate the world's influence on the self. It is not to avoid experience, but to make something of it. It is not what happens to you, but how you react that chiefly determines whether you live a contented or a miserable life. Which leads us nicely on to Montaigne, who to today's ears has perhaps the best hints for a happy living. Here's a small number. Don't worry about death. It is only a few bad moments at the end of life. Pay attention. If you fail to grab life, it will elude you. Survive love and loss. Be born, question certainties and prejudices. Neither exult when things go well, or despair when they go awry. Be on an even keel. Live temperately. Be convivial. Be ordinary and imperfect. So, no matter what our views on happiness and from whence it comes, it is clear that current Western society expects to be happy, indeed sees it as a right which sees drugs being used not for therapeutic purposes, which benefit millions, but for lifestyle enhancement. Already drugs have become like hair products or cosmetics, brain styling. A New York Times article asked, what is the real difference between pleasing ourselves and fixing ourselves? With no baseline index of mood and no objective standard of what it is to feel to be normal, there is every reason to believe that our restless pursuit of good feeling will extend an even stronger pressure to define normal happiness upward. And the pharmaceutical companies will feed that pressure. The lure of happiness will find a comfortable place in the buying and selling of medication to alter mood. It already has, says Darren McMahon. And discussing the genetic lottery by which people have a DNA disposed towards unhappiness or otherwise, he warns that the prospect of actually manipulating our genes to enhance our happiness is admittedly further off, but not that much further. But if we decide to take a fateful step in the quest to live as gods, we should know that in doing so, we will be leaving a piece of our humanity behind. And to end on an encouraging note, for at least some people in this church, Maureen Gaffney, the psychologist, writes that people in older age tend to be happier. You experience less anger. You have more control over your emotions. Your memory is increasingly biased towards the positive. And you use your emotional intelligence. Thank you.
Happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. To me, this world is a wonderful place. I'm the luckiest human in the human race. I've got no silver and I've got no gold, but I've got happiness in my soul. Happiness to me is an ocean tide, a sunset fading on a mountainside, a big old heaven full of stars above, when I'm in the arms of the one I love. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. Happiness is a field of grain, turning its face to the falling rain. I see it in the sunshine, breathe it in the air. Happiness, happiness everywhere. A wise old man told me one time, happiness is a frame of mind. When you go to measuring a man's success, don't count money, count happiness. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. I got more than my share of happiness.